Well, good morning. Hey, my name is Shane. I'm the Connections Pastor here at Washington Avenue Christian Church, which means that I get to work with our guest services team and guest connection team and also with young families. But this morning, I get to start a brand new series for us, and I'm really, really excited and honored to get to do that. But before I do, I wanted to talk to you about this pretty significant life change that happened in my life since the last time I got to be up here on the platform. If you probably don't care or remember, but the last time I got to preach, I had literally like just finished moving. Like it was the same week. It was the worst thing ever. I would not recommend preaching and moving within the same week. This time, we had a baby. Actually, we had a baby, and not just any baby, we had a baby boy, and I am so excited for that. Look at that little guy, right? Corbin John Wiley came into the world on June 1st of 2022. He weighed 7 pounds and 15 ounces. He was 20 and a quarter inches long. He's already grown, like at his two-week appointment, he had already grown over two inches and put on like a pound and a half. Like kids growing like crazy. Here's another picture of him at his 1 month old. Look at that little guy. Oh my gosh, I just want to leave right now and go home. He's actually sick today, and so he's not here, and it's the most pitiful thing in the world, right? Like a little six-week-old with congestion and a cough. He's just like, oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. I just want to leave right now. You guys can just read your Bibles, and I'm going to go home. All right, hey, so we're starting this new series this week called Kingdom People, and it's kind of got me thinking, being awake with a six-week-old baby in the middle of the night, and not that I'm doing much of that. My wife is a champion, and she's handling most of that. Don't judge me, please, but that's just how it is. She's a wonderful, wonderful person, but long days and long nights have kind of just gotten me thinking. I'm a thinker anyway, and so I've been thinking a lot about family trees and about legacy and about our roots and our background and all of this stuff, which is what we're going to be talking about today in our message. So in preparation for this week's message, you know, it's summertime, and I don't know about for you guys, but like for us, our family, we do a family reunion every other year or so. I have a lot of family actually up in South Dakota, which I just said like a South Dakotan, which was weird. South Dakota, right? There we go. We don't go up to the family reunions every year. So every other year, they come down here, and so we're a little bit more off. But maybe that's just our family. Maybe you guys don't do family reunions that often, but I think summertime, that's one of the things I equate with summertime, is family reunions. And so I was sitting at a table with some friends the other day, and I asked, like, hey, do you guys have any wild and crazy stories of, like, just, you know, rebel family members or weird, awkward things that happened at family reunions, anything like that? And this one person across the table from me chimed in and says, yeah, my parents met at a family reunion. Okay. Actually, you know, that explains a lot about this person, right? I was so flabbergasted that I didn't even think to, like, follow up, like, so... So I had to like circle back to the conversation later and be like, wait, so you said your parents met at a family reunion, right? Like I didn't mishear that. Yeah, they did. And I was like, so were they just like there as friend? Like what happened there? And they're like fourth or fifth cousins, which I guess makes it okay. I don't know. They met as little kids. They have distinct memories of like hunting Easter eggs together at their family reunion. So I don't Works out, right? I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. So I'm just going to move right along. Our families tell us about who we are, right? Like, our families tell us about who we are. I didn't know that this person was going to be here, but we have, like, a renowned family historian sitting in one of the front pews over here. It's kind of throwing me off just because I'm talking about family reunions and things like that. And I'm so glad that you're here. So our families tell us who we are. Right? They tell us about who we come from and where we come from. And so what I want us to do today is to hopefully understand better who we are and who we come from. We're in this new series, like I said, called Kingdom People. And what we're going to be doing over the next 7 weeks, including today, is looking at the Gospel of Matthew. And in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus gives five sermons. And in those five sermons, each one of them tells us about the kingdom that he came to establish. So next week, we're going to do all of the Sermon on the Mount in one sermon, right? We're going to look at a 30,000-foot view of the Sermon on the Mount. The week after that, we're going to focus on Jesus' sending sermon to his disciples in Matthew chapter 10. After that, we're going to look at the parable, the Sermon of Parables in Matthew chapter 13, the kingdom of heaven is like. After that, we're going to do Matthew 18, which is how does the kingdom operate together in community, like all of those of us within the kingdom together, like how are we supposed to treat each other? 23 looks at the Israelites and specifically the Pharisees who are supposed to be representatives of the kingdom and are not. So Jesus says to them, the kingdom of heaven is not like this. It's not like these guys. And then 24 and 25 is like, here's what it's going to look like when the kingdom of heaven comes in full. I'm really, really, really excited for the series. But what I want us to do today is just to lay a little bit of groundwork, all right? We're going to just, this is a setup sermon is what we call this. And we're going to understand a little bit more of what Matthew is trying to say to us on a large scale. And then we're going to go all the way back to the very, very beginning of the book of Matthew and see what we can learn about Jesus' family tree, okay? So when you're reading your Gospels, right? There are some big things that all four of the Gospels say about Jesus and who he is, and right? So what's going to follow is not me saying that they're not saying this, it's just also that they're saying something else as well. Because each one of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, are all written from a particular perspective with a particular perspective in mind. And each one of the four Gospels wants to make something absolutely clear about who Jesus is, right? And so what I want to do for you today is just give you, over the course of the next 10 to 12 minutes, is to give you a Bible study tool that you can use when you're reading the Gospel to know, any of the four Gospels, to know and understand what the author wants you to know about Jesus. Sound like a plan? Well, I have the microphone, so even if you don't like it, too bad, right? So Matthew is our first gospel, right? It's not the first one written. That was probably Mark, but Matthew is the first one in order. Don't ask me why. I do not know. But Matthew wants us to know something very, very specific about Jesus. He agrees and affirms all the other things that all the other gospels say about Jesus. But Matthew, he's a Jew, right? And he's writing to a Jewish audience. And when Matthew is a Jew writing to a Jewish audience, he wants to answer one question specifically. What Matthew wants to answer is this: is Jesus the king we've been waiting for? If you know the history of the Jewish people from 1 Samuel, right, which is a long, 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 long time ago, they've been wanting a king. They had a king. His name was God. God was their king. They decided, we don't like God being our king. We can't really, like, see him or touch him or talk to him, you know, without this, like, go-between. We want a king that will be for us and represent us and look like us. And so they go to their mediator. His name was Samuel. That's why the book's called 1 Samuel. They go to Samuel, and they say, hey, Samuel, we don't want God to be our king anymore. We want, a king, you know? And he's like, well, you got one. His name's God. And they're like, no. We want a real king. You got one. His name's God. They're like, no, we want one like everybody else has. So Samuel goes to God, and he's like, God, man, like, they're rejecting me as your representative. And God says, no, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. So this is what you need to tell them. If they reject me as their king and have their own king, this is what it's going to look like. He gives this long list of things. They're going to have to pay taxes, you know, and they're going to have to, their women will become slaves, and their daughters and sons will become slaves, and their sons will be sent off to war to die, all of these bad, terrible things. And Samuel's like, that sounds pretty terrible. I'll tell him. He goes and tells the Israelite people, these are all the things that will happen when God isn't your king. And they say, sounds good, sign us up, give us a king. So Samuel goes back to God and he's like, hey, they don't want you as their king. God says, give them what they want. Which leads us to Saul. And you may have heard of this guy named Saul. He was a pretty terrible king, right? He did all of the things that God said that kings were going to do. and then some, right? After Saul came this guy named David. You've probably heard of him. He was a good king. He had some flaws. We'll talk about those in a little bit. After David came Solomon, who was a good king, got to build the temple, also had some flaws. We'll talk about those as well. And after Solomon, it was just this series of good king, bad king, good king, bad king, good king, bad king. Like this guy named Rehoboam, Solomon's son, right? He did things that said were awful in the sight of the Lord, and he ended up dividing the kingdom of Israel into two, the northern and the southern kingdom. So all that to say, the people of God, the Jews, the Israelites, they've been wanting a king for thousands and thousands of years. And now they don't have one at all. Now they are under the oppressive empire of Rome. Their king is Caesar. But they want their king. And this is what Matthew breaks the silence of 400 years by saying. He opens his gospel and says, this is a record of the ancestors of Jesus Christ. Time out. I think that you're all smart, but just in case there's one or two goofy people in here, Christ is not his last name, right? It's not like Mary and Joseph Christ got together and had a baby and his name was Jesus Christ. No, Christ means king, right? So this is the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the king, the descendant of David. This is Matthew 1:1, the descendant of Abraham. What Matthew wants to show us more than anything is that Jesus is the king that the people have been waiting for, which is why the rest of the series of Matthew's gospel paints Jesus as a king. And Jesus gives sermons like Matthew chapter 13, where he says the kingdom of heaven is like. Jesus' first public words are repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus is a king. So that's Matthew, right? I think that I forgot to tell you that the way in which you can find out what each gospel writer wants to show us who Jesus is by looking at the genealogies in the gospels, right? So you don't have to look any further than Matthew 1:1 to say and see, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the king, the son of David, the son of Abraham, like king, king, and Jew, right? So Matthew wants us to know from the get-go that Jesus is a king. And I didn't tell you this in enough time for you to flip over, but if you were to do a quick cursory flip through Mark, you would notice that, well, there's no genealogy in Mark, which kind of goes against my theory, yeah? It's kind of a problem. So here's the thing. In the ancient world, everybody had genealogies, right? That's kind of where you got your honor and your value and your position from. Like, if I could, you know, prove that I was connected to King Solomon, well, then you better defer to me on decisions and you better give me the proper amount of honor. Everybody had a genealogy except for slaves. Because if you're a slave, then somewhere something went awry and you are, you're a slave. And I don't care how you got to be here. I don't care who comes before you or who comes after you. You're a slave and you're meaningless. You don't mean anything. You don't deserve a genealogy. And in Mark, there are no genealogies for Jesus at all. But there is the verse Mark chapter 10, 46, 7, 8. The Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served. Thank you, Alice. The Son of Man did not come to be served. I need you. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And what you see in the Gospel of Mark is Jesus consistently taking a role of a servant. You see, Matthew wrote to Jews. Mark is writing to Gentiles. And not only is he writing to Gentiles, he's specifically writing to Gentiles in the city of Rome. So they don't have any of the Jewish background that Matthew's Jewish audience has. They don't necessarily care about the history of Israel or anything like that. They care about power. They care about political influence. They care about money. And what Mark wants to show them is that Jesus is a king, just like Matthew wants to show them, but his kingdom and his kingship looks different than what you guys are used to. They're used to Caesar, and Jesus and Caesar, they don't get along very well at all. So Matthew, king. Mark, slave. Luke, he's a Gentile too. He's actually a Gentile. Mark was a Jew, just writing to Gentiles. Luke is a Gentile. Luke is a doctor. Luke is very, very smart, right? He wants to write and highlight all of the technical things. So his Greek is really, really hard. It's really, really advanced. And he cares a lot about like the sciencey things. And he spends a lot of time on Jesus' healings and on his miracles and things like that. And in Luke chapter 3, you come across a genealogy that traces Jesus all the way back to Adam. Because what's going on at the time is there's this belief system called Gnosticism, right? Gnosticism wants to say that the divine and the created, they can't intermingle at all. They can't intermingle at all. They have to be totally separate. And so Luke's audience had no problem with the divinity of Jesus whatsoever, but what they struggled with was the humanity of Jesus. So Luke writes to say Jesus is connected to Adam. Jesus is fully God, yes, but he is fully man. Which brings us to John. And again, you may be thinking, I don't remember a genealogy in John. It doesn't look like a long list of names. It's pretty short. It goes like this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's John's genealogy, right? He wants us to know and see the mirror image of what Luke wants us to know and see. Luke says Jesus is fully man. John says Jesus is fully God, which is why within the Gospel of John, you get seven different I am statements, seven different statements of Jesus saying who he is and using the same name that God gave to himself when he introduced himself to Moses in the burning bush. You remember the story, right? There's this burning bush. Moses, it says, hey, Moses, like, go free my people from Egypt. And he's like, okay, cool. Should I tell them the fiery burning bush guy sent me or what? God says, no, you tell them, I am that I am sent you. Ego eimi, that's the term there that we use. It's the same term that Jesus says, ego eimi, I am the light of the world. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way and the truth and the life. Jesus is saying in the Gospel of John that I am fully God. And I may have just bored the heck out of you for 12 minutes, right? But hopefully what I did was to just equip you with a little Bible study tool that you can file away and remember whenever you're starting to read a new gospel. That, oh yeah, Matthew wants to show me that Jesus is a king. How can I see Jesus developing as a king throughout this gospel? Or Mark wants to show me that Jesus is a servant. How can I see this play out in Jesus' story from Mark's perspective? I want to go back to Matthew because that's where we're going to be for the next 7 weeks. And what I want us to do is to look at the genealogy of Jesus. Because here's what I believe, is that before we talk about what it looks like to be a kingdom person, we have to decide whether or not we are a kingdom person. And my fear and my concern this morning is that some of you may feel like you're disqualified from being a kingdom person because of what's been done to you or what you've done in the past. And I hope that at the end of these next few moments that we're going to have together, as we pull out some of these names, that you're going to see that nothing in the world can disqualify you from being a kingdom person except one thing. So as we look at the genealogy of Jesus, there are lots and lots of names. If I had a guess, I would bet that you've never read it, right? If I had a guess, I would bet that when you start your Bible reading plan and you get to Matthew, you start at 1:18, right? Or is it 1:17? Yeah, 1:18. This is how Jesus the Messiah was born, right? It's a good place to start. We don't care about the long list of names before. They're awkward and uncomfortable and hard to pronounce, and we don't know very much about most of them, right? Like, we don't know very much about Zadok. I don't know who that guy is. Do you know? Anybody know Zadok? Bob might, because he's brilliant, but not me, right? But when you look at this list of names, there's some very, very interesting names that crop up here. You'll notice at right at the very beginning in verse 2, Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac is the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. That's the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So we know a lot about those guys, right? We can get excited about that. We know that Abraham was faithful to the core, that God called him and said, hey, if you will leave your homeland and go to the place that I'll show you, I will make you a blessing to all the nations. And Abraham says, sure, sounds good, let's go. And he does. And then he gets into this foreign land and he starts to worry about his wife. And all of a sudden he's like, yo, man, Sarah. Sarah, you're really pretty. And I'm worried that whenever other people see how pretty that you are, they're gonna take you away from me, or worse, they're gonna kill me as your husband so that they can take you. So if anybody asks, for the foreseeable future, you're my sister. Abraham, for all of his faith, had no faith that God would take care of his family. Right? This happens twice. Isaac, for all of his cunning and all of his smartness, doesn't know how to get along with his brother. He steals the birthright, he steals the blessing, and he doesn't have enough faith that God is going to execute that through him, and so he runs away from his brother who he thinks is going to murder him, right? And then Jacob has his struggles as well. Even the very best people that we see here have their struggles. You can go on down the line and other names start to pop up. Boaz, we know a little bit about Boaz. We know about Jesse and about this guy named King David, right? We know about this guy named Solomon. We know a lot about Solomon. There are some other names we don't know so much about. But here's what we do know about every single name on this list, whether or not we know anything else about them at all, right? What we can know is that they were human.
Duh.
Right? And if they were human, then they were broken. We may not know what their brokenness looked like, but we do know without a shadow of a doubt that they are broken. And in spite of their brokenness, here they are in the family tree of Jesus. Matthew's genealogy is really, really, really exceptional because Matthew's genealogy does what very, very few genealogies in the ancient world did. And not only does it do it once, it does it five times. Five times, Matthew's genealogy lists women. So if we can we dig around in their stories for just a minute? Because I don't think that it's without reason that Matthew lists five women. The five women that Matthew lists start off with this young lady named Tamar. And you may or may not know the story of Tamar, so let me give you a quick refresher course real quick. First of all, the first thing that you need to know about Tamar, she's a Canaanite, right? She is an enemy of the people of God, and yet somehow she marries Judah's son. Now, if you read the text, right, then something is already sounding weird because I just told you that Tamar married Judah's son, but the text says that Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. So that's weird, right? Here's what happened. Tamar marries Judah's oldest son. He is a scoundrel. We don't know anything about him other than it says that his actions displeased God and God killed him. He killed him before he and Tamar could have children together. So in the ancient Jewish world, there's this kind of really weird rule where if your husband dies before he gives you any children, before you have any children, then it's the younger brother's job to have a child with this woman, all right? So older brother dies, younger brother named Onan comes in, and well, as sensitively as I can, he gets most of the way to having a child with Tamar, but removes himself from the situation before he can, right? You can read about it in Genesis 38 if you want to, but that's all I'm going to say about that, all right? Other than that, God did not like that because Onan was not doing what he was supposed to do either, and so God struck Onan dead, right? So now Judah is looking at the situation, and he says, I have two dead sons, and the common denominator is this gal Tamar, right? And so he's got another son. He says, Tamar, I need you to hold off until he gets a little bit older so that he can fulfill his duty. But he's too young right now, all the while knowing that she's never marrying him because he's going to die too. So a long period of time goes by. Judah's wife dies. Tamar realizes that, hey, like things are not working the way that they're supposed to work here, and I'm being taken advantage of. So Tamar dresses herself up like a prostitute, figures out that Judah is going to be traveling from this city to this city, positions herself on the way from this city to this city, knowing that Judah's wife had just died and that he's probably going to be deep in his feelings and might need some comforting. So she plants herself as a prostitute on the way. Judah comes and sees her. Remember, the ancient world, like it wasn't like, you can see their face. No, he had no idea who he was talking to. He just knows that he's talking to a prostitute. He propositions her to go to bed with him. She says, yes, what are you going to pay me? Because I'm a prostitute and I need to be paid. He said, I'm going to give you my robe cord and my walking stick. She says, you got yourself a deal, mister. They go and do the deed. He goes on about his way. She goes back home. By the time he gets home, she realizes that she's pregnant by Judah, her father-in-law. She goes to Judah and says, hey, dad, I'm pregnant and it's yours. He says, no way whatsoever. I'm a widower. I can't have a baby. She says, you want to bet? And he says, yeah, I do. And she pulls out his cord and his walking stick. He says, gotcha. All of that to perpetuate the line of Jesus. So we've got one woman. She's a Canaanite, and for at least a little bit, kind of acted like a prostitute. The next woman on the list, her name's Rahab, right? Rahab, also a Canaanite, actually was a prostitute, right? She puts up the spies who are scouting around in Jericho to figure out what's about to happen and how they can conquer the city. She understands that, like, hey, these people are on a mission from God. I need to take care of them. She does. She hides them. She's saved. She's a prostitute. She gets married to a Jew. She's in the family tree of David. So we've got, of Jesus, rather, and David. We've got two women, two Canaanites, two prostitutes. Great family tree, Jesus. The next woman that we come across, her name is Ruth. Ruth, not a Canaanite, but a Moabite, which is basically the same thing, right? She stumbles into the property of this man named Boaz. Boaz is a good-looking dude. She had a husband before, but he died. So her and her mother-in-law, they're just kind of wandering around trying to find work. She finds work on this guy named Boaz's property, and her mother-in-law, Naomi, is like, yo, Boaz is a stud, and you should marry him. She's like, well, he's noble and honorable and a Jew, and I am a widowed Gentile woman. It's not going to happen. So Naomi says, try this, all right? Why don't you just, like, go into his room, and the text says, uncover his feet and see what happens from there. So scholars are a little bit divided, right? And I want to be clear and honest about that we don't really know what, like, uncover his feet means, but it could mean either just, like, crawl in bed with him and see what happens, or it could mean, like, make something happen, lady, all right? The uncovering of the feet. But either way, what we have is now a third woman who is a Gentile who probably has some sexual scandal attached to at least a portion of her life. Woman number four, her name's not mentioned, but we know who she is. Solomon was the son of David by the wife of Uriah. Bathsheba is not mentioned, but she's a part of Jesus' family tree. And in case we don't know the story of Bathsheba, right, David's on his rooftop. Instead of at battle where he's supposed to be, and while he's on his rooftop, he looks out across his kingdom and he sees this woman named Bathsheba, ironically taking a bath. He says, she's hot stuff, send her up. So she sends some guards, sends some guards to get her. She comes up, finds out, hey, David, she's like, oh, I'm married. David says, well, I don't care about that. They sleep together. She gets pregnant. David finds out, tries to bring Uriah back from the war that David's supposed to be at to sleep with his wife so that they can excuse the pregnancy. Doesn't happen. Uriah's too noble. He sleeps on King David's front doorstep so that he's not tempted to go home to his wife, because he says, if the guys out at the battlefield can't sleep with their wives, then I don't deserve to be with mine. So he sleeps on David's doorstep, goes back to the battle the next day. David writes a letter to the general that says, hey, get Uriah killed. Uriah carries his own death sentence letter, gives it to the general. The general's like, all right, everybody pull back. Uriah goes forward. He dies. Bathsheba marries David. Everybody finds out, or rather, David is confronted about what has happened. He is repentant and remorseful. The child that is pregnant, he's pregnant with Bathsheba, ends up dying, but they remain married, and Solomon is the next son born to David and Bathsheba. Are we tracking, right? So now, and by the way, Uriah, not even a Jew. He was a Hittite. We don't know whether or not Bathsheba was a Jew or a Gentile, but she was married to a Gentile, which means we can probably assume she's a Gentile too. So now we got four women, four Gentiles, four stories of sexual scandal. You tracking? This is Jesus' family tree. One more, you ready? Little girl, her name's Mary. She is a Jew. 13, 14 years old, probably engaged to a guy named Joseph, and all of a sudden she's pregnant. But I'm a virgin. The Holy Spirit got me pregnant. Okay, Mary. Good talk. Holy Spirit, okay. Either you and Joseph couldn't hold off, or Joseph was a little too old for you, not quite your cup of tea, and you went and found your own. Either way, scandalous. And I told you those five stories. And I wanted to talk to you about this genealogy of Jesus, because what I see is foreigners. What I see is hurt and pain and brokenness, greed, scandal, addiction, depression and anxiety. And yet, every single one of these people finds themselves comfortably in the family tree of Jesus. Which leads me to believe that the only thing that can qualify us, rather, that can disqualify us, the only thing that can disqualify us from the kingdom is to reject the king. Jesus doesn't care about what you've done. Jesus doesn't care about what's been done to you. And you may be thinking to yourself, well, yeah, Shane, like that's Jesus's family. He can't really control it. He kind of can and kind of did, but we'll leave that to the side. Jesus's family tree didn't end with Jesus. Now, I'm no Dan Brown advocating that Jesus had children, but what I am saying is that Jesus, just like he created a different kingdom than the world has ever experienced before, he's created a different family tree than the world has ever experienced before. And just like my family tree doesn't end with me, it's going to continue through Corbin and Janessa. Jesus's family tree continues through you and me and all of those of us who call on his name and submit to himself to him as our Lord. And if that is the case, then friends, the only thing, the only reason that you will ever be disqualified from being a kingdom person is when, if you reject the king. We're all part of families. Every single one of us. Some of us are part of really, really great families. Some of us are part of really, really, really terrible families. Whether your family is great or terrible, I promise you, it's broken. And no matter what, if you, every single day, you have an opportunity to stop or to perpetuate both the goodness and the brokenness of your family. Every single day, I have the opportunity in parenting Corbin and Janessa, I have the opportunity to perpetuate or to stop the goodness or the brokenness of my family. Every single day, I have the opportunity in parenting Corbin and Janessa to stop or perpetuate their growth as Jesus' disciples, their growth as kingdom people. So I don't know what your background is. I don't know what has got you here today. I have no idea why you're in the room. Maybe you've been coming and you've been sitting in the same spot for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Or maybe this is your very, very first time at Washington Avenue Christian Church. Maybe this is your first time at any church ever and you're kind of confused and you're not sure why you're here and you're not sure what this young guy in a flowery shirt's talking about. Here's what I want you to know is that regardless of why you're here, Jesus has something to say to you. You are here because the long-standing desire of Israel to have a king that is a physical, tangible king that they can talk to and that will talk to them was fulfilled in the life of Jesus. And that Jesus didn't just come and rule and reign and die, and that was the end of it. Jesus came and he lived a life contrary to any life that we've ever seen before. He lived a perfect life, a life that you and I can only dream about, that we probably can't even fathom. And his reward for that was being hung on a cross, which is, by the way, where Rome hung wannabe kings who wanted to start new kingdoms. He was hung on a cross, and he died on that cross. He died on the cross, he was taken off of that cross, and he was buried for 3 days. And on the third day, one of his disciples, a young lady named Mary Magdalene, who was a prostitute until she encountered Jesus, went to go find his body, to prepare his body for long-term burial. She couldn't find it in the garden at all. She couldn't find it in the tomb. She panics, and she runs around. She's trying to find it, and she runs into this gardener. She says, "Please, sir, tell me where you've put the body. If you've moved it, I'll move it back." She didn't know that the gardener was Jesus. He turns to her and he speaks to her, and she recognizes the compassion in his voice, and she recognizes the look in his eye, and she understands that Jesus is alive, and that same Jesus that was alive then and appeared to over 500 people, he's alive today, and he may or may not be appearing to you today. He may be talking to you right now, inviting you and beckoning you into his kingdom. I don't want to assume, I think it's an unfair assumption to make, that everybody in here is a part of the kingdom. And maybe you even think that you are because you do the whole church thing every week. Guys, that's not it, right? And what we're going to be discovering for the next 6 weeks together is what a kingdom person actually looks like. But the first step is to know and understand that all of us, regardless of what we've done, regardless of what's been done to us, regardless of the baggage that we carry and the hurt and the pain, all of us qualify for the kingdom if and when we accept the King. So Father, would you help us this morning? Would you give us boldness to talk about what that might mean and what that might look like for us? God, would you give us courage? Would you open our hearts and our minds and our eyes to understand who you are and what you've done for us? God, would you help us to understand that you're not just some ethereal, big, inconceivable thing. You're all of those things, but God, you're a person and not just a person, but a king. And a king that doesn't rule with a heavy iron fist. You don't rule with taxes and slavery and war. You rule with peace and love and grace, and you want to rule in our lives. God, I believe that there are people in this room who haven't submitted to you as their king before, and I pray and I hope and I ask that maybe today would be the day that they submit to you for the first time. God, give them courage. Thank you for inviting us to be a part of your family as well. Thanks for Jesus. Amen. If you want to talk, if you have thoughts or questions, this is weird, man, come up, don't hesitate. Come find me, come find another staff member here. Help us, let us talk to you and walk through this process of what it means to be a kingdom person with you and for you. I promise that the rest of the series over the next 6 weeks are going to make a lot more sense if you're already on the right team. So let us help you get there, okay? Thank you.
Let's stand and sing this as a declaration together.
Thank you. decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. Decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back.
God bless you, family, as you go and become kingdom people this week.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to worship experience at Washington Avenue Christian Church, where real people experience real grace. We're thrilled that you have chosen to spend a little bit of your Sunday morning with us. And if this is your first time, or if you have been viewing us for just a couple of weeks, would you do us a favor and text the word welcome to the number at the bottom of your screen, and we would love to get in touch with you. Now, if you need prayer or have any kind of concerns, you can text pray to that exact same number that's on your screen. And maybe you made the decision today to follow Jesus. We are so, so excited about that, and we would love to celebrate that with you. So go ahead and text believe to that number, and somebody will be in touch with you to celebrate and to help you find your next steps soon. We're just real people experiencing real grace here at Washington Avenue Christian Church, and we're looking forward to seeing you next week.